This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Very well. How are you?
Doing good. Anything new on the horizon going on since last time we talked?
I don't think so. I don't recall. I think that chatter's more or less died down, so I don't know if there's anything significant on the horizon that you've heard, Jen?
On that topic specifically, yeah. Just the executive order, we have other governmental, wheels are in motion to basically try to check the court. So it'll be interesting. It's just an itty bitty little constitutional crisis. No problem. Yeah. So, but I think it's too early to prognosticate too much on any of that. I mean, we'll just see how everything goes, and it's obviously going to define the entire election cycle. So we'll have plenty of opportunity to talk about it, I'm sure.
Yeah. And we have bigger fish to fry here on this podcast.
Yeah.
Or should I say tofu steaks?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cauliflower steaks. This is whole food, plant based.
All right. Well, let's see what we got.
Well, our tofu cauliflower steaks are the following. Dear doctors, if your relationship status is single, would you only look to someone with your diet lifestyle as someone you'd only be interested in dating and possibly pair bond with? This question is for Dr. Jen and Dr. Lyle.
Absolutely.
Deal breaker.
Yeah, that's the individual.
My answer is very simple. My answer is, I know it's not a deal breaker for you.
No, it's not. And the more attractive the woman, the less important it becomes.
And now the truth comes out about your ethical commitments.
Yeah. No, I have no ethics. It's just ruthless cost benefit analysis all the way down.
Frank Underwood all the way down.
That's it. life has been tough enough without adding that additional hurdle. But the adapted mind doesn't have choices in terms of how it draws its lines. So Jen is a ruthless line drawer on that, and I'm not. And that's how it works. That's how our minds are built individually differently there. And it's not,
and it wasn't.
There's no prescription for anybody. You know, it's your own adaptive unconscious runs the CB on all these things, and they're very complicated. It arrives, and the only thing that will ever change it is significant new information that the brain with its essentially reasoning and fact-checking, mechanisms that are built into it, will determine that the new information or new concepts or new ideas are true, and they replace old ideas and therefore alter the cost-benefit analysis and then change the behavioral trajectory. So, but basically what I'm saying is that, at this point, I don't think I'm going to learn anything new in this arena, and Jen probably isn't either, and so what you're watching is you're watching the natural sort of decisions that two different brains make, on a similar problem. That's just how it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of that learning is experiential too. I mean,
yeah.
Of course it would have to be, because sure. I wasn't always so committed to that position. I was, when I was first vegan and even whole food plant-based vegan, I was more open to that question and thought, mm-hmm. As long as it's relatively balanced and the guy's not eating, nasty processed meat all the time. Maybe I can live with it. And what happened was experience. What happened mm-hmm. was dating a few guys and just feeling really grossed out and realizing that it actually was a threshold that just was too much for me. Right. And so that adjustment happened by stages. And there was sort of like one experience in particular that was especially noxious. And if that mm-hmm. hadn't happened, I can see myself being a little more open-minded on the question. So right. even though I feel right. really strongly for my own choices, that mm-hmm. my ethics are strong on this question.
Yeah.
but I can see having a little more, you know, live and let live attitude towards someone I was dating, as long as they didn't bring it in the house, which was pretty consistent for a long time until the especially noxious experience and a couple of others. And finally, I was just like, you know what, it's just too gross. I just can't deal. So, yeah. Oh, well, yeah. my tiny little dating pool just got that much tinier.
There you go.
Exactly. Yeah. Totally.
Exactly. No, yeah. I understand. I think that for me, the line is a little bit different, and that is that the line is around health consciousness. So yeah. if the person is not health conscious and has an attitude that they really don't care and they don't believe that anybody really knows anything. I remember I went out with a woman once, a Match.com date, and, you know, somehow I didn't mean for the discussion. I think I would never do that, but people ask me what I do and then they start cross-examining me and it's going to come out. You know, they're, and so it's going to come out, and I'm as casual and pleasant and open and flexible sounding as a person could possibly be, you know, without actually ordering a hamburger and fries. In other words, I'm really freaking non-judgmental. And yet, I remember this woman was like, had this attitude of, well, you know, nobody really knows anything, and you know, it's all whatever. And I remember, like,
my truth is just as good as your truth.
Totally. And I remember just starting to gently educate her, you know, just really light touch, and getting this bristle. And that was a rule out. It's like, okay, well, if number one, you're not health conscious, i.e. you don't even rate it as something that is objectively verifiable, and therefore, of course, it would not be worth paying attention to if there is no truth. Okay, if there's no correlation coefficient between anything and anything, then why have any thought at all? And so but then when I can determine, okay, no health consciousness or minimal, and then also no interest in learning.
Yeah, that's okay. The bigger deal. Oh, yeah. For you in particular. Sure. It's sort of like, oh, this just, you know, rigidity, this sort of ideological, no, I think I actually, I know how this is.
No, Ben.
It's like, you're... there is this, in principle, there is, yeah. I mean, this is the kind of feedback that you get from a lot of strong ideological positions out there on all kinds of topics,
right.
where you ask a question like, well, what evidence would it take to convince you otherwise? And you get something back like, well, there's nothing that could convince me otherwise.
Right.
I just know that I'm right.
So why are we talking?
Yeah, right. Like,
exactly.
It's either you agree with me and there's nothing to debate, or you don't agree with me and there's nothing to debate.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah. Yeah. So those would be two really big rule out signals,
right.
I think, for sure. For me, too.
Yes.
And so it's a combination of all those things. But for me, as a female, more beholden to sort of a visceral disgust response,
right.
Governing my choices and behavior, I just found myself, even though intellectually I wanted that not to be in the mix because mm-hmm. it did limit the pool so dramatically,
mm-hmm.
I really just didn't have a choice about the matter. It was just totally non-negotiable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I have found that... women that I've been with, very few, obviously, but that I have, they, if they're interested in me, they listen, they learn, and they modify their behavior. And so, therefore, I'm not going to rule out anybody unless I hear those obvious constraints, because they're, and I don't think it's good because I'm so persuasive or anything. I think that women are more inherently interested in nutrition. This is well known, you know, in sociological analysis, and they're the nurture, feed people, you know, food persons. That's who's going to be feeding your children. So they often, particularly bright women, they're the people that I'm going to be talking to. They would, you know, a reasonable person of reasonable conscientiousness is going to have a reasonable amount of interest in learning, And most guys aren't going to be interested in sitting there and talking to him about food, but I would be. And so as a result, they, you know, I can't remember getting any serious pushback from anybody about my position, obviously, because I've got, you know, I've got credentials that are a mile long. So it's obvious that this is going to be, you know, very gentle and open-mindedly and aw shucks and hey, whatever. But hey, I know and you don't know. And if you got a question, ask me because I'm the authority. And so that is, that has been, so I have found bright, interesting, decent people that I would like to know anyway, and they'd like to know me, are listening and modifiable. So not surprising that Jen, you know, hasn't found that on the other side, because men aren't that interested in this topic.
A little more stubborn, a little more disagreeable, and not inherently interested in the topic.
Yes.
Yeah. Although I've told the story before, where this would be sort of a way, or it's not necessarily a cautionary tale. It's really just a lesson for women, where if he's not willing to display some of that behavioral modification, you know, you've probably not got a pair bond on your hands. So, I had this poor schmuck who was coming out from the city. This is when I was living in Santa Rosa to go to some Thai restaurant in Santa Rosa, and he picked it out ahead of time, and we were talking on the phone like the night before, and he made some joke about Thai food, and I told him I was vegetarian. I think that's what I led with. I didn't want to, you know, expose him to the whole truth all at once.
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, well, that's okay. I'll eat all the extra animals for you." And I was like, "Oh boy, okay.
Yeah.
I need to educate you a little bit. I need to let you know that you know, this is actually a really important kind of personal and ethical choice for me, and I don't see myself potentially getting serious with anyone who eats animals, just to let you know." Which normally I would not do before a first date. I'd at least get the guy to the table first before laying this on him. But in this case, because he'd made this terrible joke, I went ahead and did it. And he put the brakes on so fast. He was like, "Oh God, okay. Well, I mean, is there somewhere you'd prefer to go? Is there a better idea, a better place? And you know, we can do whatever." And then the poor guy shows up at the date, and he's so worried about it. He wants me to order for him. He's like, "Well, what would be okay here? You know, I want to make sure that I'm, you know. And he was very earnest and very sweet and very over rewarded, and it was darling. But you know, that was just like, that's a necessary but not sufficient condition. And actually, you know, although it was a little bumbling and awkward, it did endear him to me a bit. And I didn't rule him out over that. I ruled him out later in the conversation because he got stubborn about his ex-wife's borderline personality diagnosis and how that was a result of her childhood and her erratic mother, et cetera, et cetera. And it's what you sign up for with the Hawkster. He just really dug his heels in on that and clearly was not intellectually curious. And so it was the same principle. It was like, okay, well, this has been nice. Enjoyed the noodles. Have a nice night. Yeah.
Didn't want to learn from the PhD from Harvard.
Yeah, it's like, interested. Go listen to 200 podcasts and call me in the morning.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is like, it's a little difficult out there, essentially, for both of us, because in domain after domain, our positions are extreme.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's like, you know, we're both actually very pleasant. I'm Jen's naturally pleasant. I'm reasonable, but I get real nice on a date.
Depending on how attractive she is.
Of course. But the point is that, you know, I'm not out to bang anybody over the head with anything, because I'm there to learn about them, and I'll gently guide, you know, around my, you know, what mutual interests we may find, and then I'll share some interesting things, and I won't say, "Well, actually, that's my idea, and it's extremely well developed, and let me start you at square number one. Let me take the camera back for you."
That's until you start drawing on the tablecloth, at least.
That's right. So, but anyway, yeah, I think that, yeah, that's interesting. I think that we sort of stumbled onto a little bit of our differences in strategy, and I think reasonable reasons for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. All right.
We always think our reasons are very reasonable.
Yeah.
as they are, right? I mean, I wonder if it's
how could they be otherwise?
I wonder if it's a false correlation on my part, because I've met different people, you know, throughout my life, and it seems that women are much quicker to rule things out and have these hard, fast, you know, absolutely no's.
Rules.
Whereas men are like, well, you know, it just depends. It depends on the situation. Depends on everything. It's like you said, Dr. Lauf, the more attractive somebody is, both physically and you know, mentally, brains, personality, you're willing to deal with a lot more if everything else is okay. Whereas women are more like, you know, no to this, no to that, no to that, you know, as if there's so many options out there.
She in principle is going into that date as her forever pair bond. Mm-hmm. She's not casually mating oriented, and he's got a casual mating window open always. Mm-hmm. And so if she's crazy and has all kinds of demands, that's okay. I'll still sleep with her. I just won't marry her.
Plan B strategy.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So whether he's consciously aware of it or not, but she does not have that plan B in her pocket most of the time. She is picturing wedding bells on date one. Yeah.
Much more expensive if you make a false positive. Yeah.
Totally. Okay. Totally. And if you've got some noxious traits, you know, we can't accommodate that.
In this marriage. Off with his head.
Yeah.
All right, Nathan, what do we got?
All right. Dear doctors, can spirituality fit into evolutionary psychology, for example, Taoism or other religions?
I think I let Jen just wind out however you want. I would have a couple comments about that, but no big deal. But go, just what crosses your mind there?
Yeah, well, the framing is so open and vague. I mean, of course it can fit, because, you know, all personalities fit into evolutionary psychology. So it's there are personalities that are very open and therefore very spiritual or spiritually oriented. I suppose there are, you know, religious personalities that are not necessarily very open, but I find that, you know, that the seeking spiritual personality tends to be open. And so I think the ways that these can fit together, there's going to be, depending on what angle you look at it from, some cognitive dissonance and irresolvable conflicts of interest within those two frameworks. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me. I continue to be a kooky, open, quasi-spiritual person who maintains some irrational spiritual wonderment at the world and can imagine that maybe there are things possible that I don't fully comprehend, or maybe there's more to the universe that I can't see, et cetera, et cetera. That can coexist very peacefully, and it's just fine and doesn't cause me a lot of distress or confusion, along with the evolutionary psychology principles. So the way I usually explain this to people when they ask this kind of question is I think of it as sort of Newtonian physics versus quantum physics. There are laws of the world. There's gravity. There are physical laws that govern our relationships, our status dynamics, all of the things that we talk about on the show all the time. But then there's also kind of the unknown. There's sort of the weirdness. There's all the stuff beyond the veil that we can't see. And I am not a personality who is comfortable feeling like we've figured it all out, it's all done, this is everything, all the evidence is in, and it's conclusive, and there will never be any change to that analysis. I can't comfortably sit there. Where I can sit is, given everything that I can see and observe and make sense of, this is how the world works. But of course, there could be things that I can't see and can't make sense of. And if those are going to inform some of my more ephemeral spiritual dippy ideas about the universe and time and space, so be it. There's no problem that I see there at all. And I think for something like Taoism or Buddhism or other traditions, but I'm actually more familiar with those, ironically, there are ways that you could think of evolutionary psychology plugging into those frameworks, where I use examples from Buddhism all the time of where they're talking about relationships between people and, you know, what success in life looks like and how you should pursue goals and all of these kinds of things that are actually informed by what we could just call common sense, human nature, observations of many millennia of how humans relate to each other, that strikes at the same kind of source code that evolutionary psychology does. Mm-hmm. So it's using different language to describe very similar dynamics. And so I can hold those two things alongside each other and learn something from each of them without having to just choose one or the other.
Yeah, in other words, there's the question and what's being defined there is so vague that we don't know what exactly they mean, and we'd have to ask them. But what I hear Jen saying here in the last part, she said a lot of different things, but the life experiences, and including those that can be synthesized by older people as they've witnessed an awful lot of human action, they're attempting to derive principles in order to make better decisions. And so what wisdom is over the millennia is it's the distilled experience where instinct and on the other side of instincts don't always fully inform you accurately about what to do. So instincts have to be inherently limited. So you have to, an instinct can be biasing a decision because the innate calculation system in your head is telling you that your 100,000 of ancestors are voting 80-20, that you need to go left when you come to this fork on the road. This is what you should do, okay? But 20% of the internal voting system is saying, wait a minute, given these circumstances, these are a little bit novel, there's a little bit hard to calculate. Here are your set of circumstances in total for your whole life situation. We 20% of us thinks that you should go to the right. Okay. Wisdom is trying to figure out those dilemmas where the instincts are incomplete. And in fact, where instincts under certain circumstances can be confused and they can be effectively trapped into making incorrect decisions. So the instinct is biasing a decision in one direction, but in fact, the better decision is to go the other direction. That, to me, is a lot of what the history of philosophy and spirituality and spiritual systems are trying to do, is they're effectively trying to tell those stories and have ways of basically stories, metaphors, sayings. In other words, they're trying to actually distill wisdom. And I would argue that the distillation of those teachings is, for one thing, it is inherently not principled. So in other words, it's not actually an integrated system of thinking. They can try very, very hard to make an integrated system of thinking, but they are not integrated because they are not all fundamentally true. Okay? All of these systems are corrupted by the fact that the teachers themselves have hierarchical problems of evolution, and they're trying to exploit people underneath them. So we're going to find that all kinds of teachings there's all kinds of agendas that can't come into the process itself. And so as a result, all philosophical systems are going to be montages of some distilled brilliance of human beings actually figuring out the limitations of their own instincts and essentially attempting to live the serenity prayer, that the wisdom to know the difference between, you know, which way to go. It's tricky as hell. So what Jen and I are doing on the backs of Charles Darwin and Tubian Cosmides and David Buss and Robert Plowman, we're attempting to distill a system of decision-making that actually is, for the first time in history, actually true and principled. That would allow you to make decisions into domains of which you don't have any experience, because you're going to be using a principle as opposed to distilled wisdom that came out of hard experience of doing the wrong thing, you know, and getting burned. So that's the... that's how I see that. So is there, quote, a room for spirituality? Whatever that means, there's a lot of room for it all over the place. In other words, I'm not sure what that person means. If they mean, is there some deity out there that's pulling strings and organizing the laws of the universe. That's for Jen's woo-woo chip and her unlimited imagination about how things could be, but makes no sense. Okay. The but when we talk about spirituality in terms of wisdom and the distillation of how to make decisions and the pithy way that, you know, Eastern spirituality can sometimes come up with a way of looking at something that's extraordinary and can distill in a few words what would take me on my best day 10,000 words to explain my thinking and why I think you should go to the right instead of the left. So that's what I see is the value deep in that spirituality. But if you mean by spirituality otherworldly, outside, etc., there are problems with believing that there's anything bizarre and tricky out there based on what we're going to call a nomological net. In other words, the truth is, because it's true, it is inherently integrated. And so all observations and all relationships of all matter and energy in the universe should be sitting under a seamless set of principles. And so when we look at the world, we have no evidence that there is anything that sits outside of those principles. So if there is anything outside, the universe is indeed quite a bit different than we think it is. Okay, so I don't believe that it is, but that's a very narrow and narrowly bounded discussion of what you would call spirituality, and I don't think a particularly important one. I think all the rest of it is where it gets interesting, and that's where, you know, that's where we have to be open to listening to all kinds of different distillations of wisdom over the centuries, because very often peoples have distilled some things that are remarkable, and as Jen has said, they can say exactly what we would say, but they're skipping over the nuts and bolts integration of how it is that we got there, but they got there anyway. And that's a beauty of spirituality.
Yeah, I think a good faith reckoning, no pun intended, although that's a pretty good pun, but a good faith reckoning of sort of a lot of, you know, what we might call spiritual paths rather than just kind of straight religious traditions, if you're going to make that kind of, I don't know, sort of just ad hoc distinction. But there are a lot of these are putting sort of a personal responsibility on the seeker. You know, mm-hmm. you're on your path, and there are consequences for your path. And so it's not so much about the external deity that is judging you and puppeting you. It's really about you reaping the consequences of your own actions and choices. And so in that sense, I think it's very compatible, and there's lots of room. And if you want to interpret it with a little bit of that, you know, extra sauce to jazz it up, I don't see anything intrinsically wrong with doing that. It's not evidence-based, but that's fine. If you're not an evidence-based kind of person and you've got the openness chip, as long as it sort of stays in that realm of, because we're absolutely saying that life is what you make it, you know, and that's why the show is called Beat Your Genes. This is about choices. It's about the places in life where you do have forks in the road, and you can choose the wisdom fork. It's just not, almost never going to be the intuitive or easy thing to do. That doesn't mean that you can't do it. And that echoes the insight of many, you know, great spiritual traditions that, you know, you do the hard thing. You're going to feel like you're all alone out there, exposed, and that there's no one coming to save you, but that is actually where the reward is. So, yeah, I think there's probably room for many books to be written about this topic. Not that anybody's motivated to do so, but
right.
it's an interesting idea.
It's a hell, actually, that, you know, one day, maybe probably in your older age, that would be an amazing, interesting book to think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I don't. Nobody's even dreamed about that, but you could actually take, you know, the 12 greatest spiritual insights and take them and say, okay, let's look at the underpinning of why it is that this is so valuable. Mm-hmm. And you could do a chapter on each one of them, basically explaining the underlying evolutionary process.
That would be really interesting. I mean, like, think of the golden rule, right?
Yes.
And sort of nurturing esteem networks.
Yes.
And you know, keeping the long term of esteem dynamics in mind in your community, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you could just go on and on with all of these. So yeah, you could take all of that sort of insight and find evolutionary logic behind it.
Absolutely. Fascinating idea. Huh. All right, Nathan.
We'll
what
finish
else we
the
got?
One we're ready.
Yeah, let's finish this one first. Yeah. All right, Nathan. Go
All right. Our last question. Dear doctors, this question is about creating an alter ego. Apparently, sports people do it, and David Goggins did it. He was a guest on Rich Roll's podcast, if anybody wants to hear more. But David Goggins was a flake, overweight, had no prospects, and by his own admission was a liar. Then he basically turned his life around, became a Navy SEAL, and said he did it by inventing an alter ego called Goggins. So does this suggest that personality can be changed? I know current theory is that it's largely inherited. He also said an important part of his transformation was the accountability mirror. You basically look in the mirror every day and be completely honest about who and what you are, and then from there you can change what you don't like about yourself. Is there any merit to this?
No.
Yeah, Doug's going to eviscerate this one.
No, this is a great example of correlation and causation being confusing for people. Okay, so so this guy did turn his life around. Why? Well, we know why. Okay, we know because what he ran was cost benefit analyses. So very often people of complex personalities, when I say complex, unusual constellations of personalities. So I don't know this man, but I will guarantee you that this guy does not have, you know, 650th percentiles down the middle of those six bell curves. There's no way in hell that's true. Okay. If he is average intelligence, average openness, average conscientiousness, average introversion, extroversion, average agreeableness, and average emotional stability, that guy did not do what he did. Okay? So if he had a, quote, remarkable transformation, you will see remarkable transformations out of people who are bizarre constellations of personalities. They may have very high intelligence. Okay? They may have very high conscientiousness, but they may have even higher openness. Okay, so it turns out, I mean, a great example is on this podcast with us. It's Jen Hawk. So Jen Hawk is an unusual personality. Obviously, everybody can tell in 3 minutes, she is screaming brilliant. That is obvious. Okay, what isn't so obvious, you have to talk to her a while and you start finding out this chick's like really open. Okay. Okay, really open, but she also has a hell of a lot of conscientiousness. So when you put those together, it's like, well, which of these things is winning? You know, what? And
they're
it's
in
like,
a battle to the death every day of my life for 40 years.
They are. So you could, Jen Hawk's transformational story is every bit as bizarre as Dave, what's his name? Every bit. Okay, so Jen Hawk was, you know, what? Some young, brilliant, superstar, card-carrying communist, you know, not too long ago.
You're outing me.
Okay, she also, you know, open and wild and with an alcoholic chip in there, was damn near dead on some Chinese junk somewhere going down a river.
That's literally true. That is not a metaphor.
Okay, so all over the place. Then the next thing we know, she's almost, you know, dead in the water at Harvard working in a coffee shop in Seattle. Okay, then the next thing we know, she finishes a superstar dissertation that the world doesn't even know about yet. But I'll tell you what, I was there when the Harvard faculty was listening to a discussion about what Jen's dissertation was, and they were very interested. They were novel ideas that they hadn't heard before. And they're like, whoa, what is that? Okay. So now here we are, and the world doesn't even really know what she's up to, but I know what she's up to. We're up to an evisceration of some of the most important corrupted and social science thought in the world that causes more damage than just about anything that could damage human existence. That's what she's up to. Okay. So I don't know what Dave Goggle or what the hell he accomplished or what shit he was in before he got his act together, but I guarantee you he wasn't six average bell curves. He was as wacky as Jen, all over the place, a monster talent that had huge Achilles heels all over the place. And so early in life, as he's experimenting and finding the limits of what it is that he could do, should do, could do, you know, what might happen, you know, what if I do this, what if I do that? He wasn't just a flake. He was a lot of other things. Now, he had some things that he did. He stared in the mirror and that turned his life around for accountability. That is horseshit. The adapted mind is what it was that caused him to have a ritual of staring in the mirror. What the fuck made him decide that? Okay. Obviously, his personality ran the computations on the cost-benefit analysis of getting accountable. So then it turned out he had a little ritual, but the ritual didn't do it. That was the effect of the underlying drive to make the change, for Christ's sakes. Okay? So, and we're going to find that the same thing is true in every move that this guy made. What do we know for sure? He is a reproductive resource acquisition device designed by nature to run very complex cost-benefit analytics to be making micro changes every nanosecond in his behavioral trajectory. When you see patterns of behavior that don't change, it's because the cost-benefit analysis is stable and the people and the person's decisions about their behavior are stable. When you see anybody change anything, i.e., I'm changing my major from pre-med to psychology. Why? Because it's too freaking tough. That's a change. Okay, what happened? Why did that happen? Cost-benefit analysis. Person realized they don't have the chops to get enough high enough grades to get into med school, so this whole damn thing's a waste of time. It's not going to do them any good at all. Better bail out now. Okay? Is that a Dave change? Goddamn right it is. Of course, it's exactly the same thing. Right? So why did he make the changes he made? He ran cost-benefit analysis. His personality did not change 0.1%. Okay? And if he thinks so, it's because he's ignorant. He doesn't know anything. Anybody that's analyzing him thinks so, doesn't make any difference. They don't know anything. Who knows anything? Who is the worldwide expert? Where is the evidence? Plowman. Okay. Robert Plowman is the Pope of personality. Whoever asks this question wants to know the truth. You simply go to Blueprint and you get out your reading glasses and you get out a notebook paper so with every word that he uses, you can look it up and then you can do 2 hours research so you understand what the hell he's talking about when he starts talking about the genetic code. This reminds me, my long-term, now life best friend, but ex-partner, Melissa, would look at ads on television with beautiful women talking about what they do for their beautiful skin. And she'd just crack up. She's like, oh yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly the same concept.
Every day I get up in the morning and I bathe with Dove cleansing cream. That's why my skin looks like this. No, honey, that is not why that skin looks like. This is Victoria Principle. I write a book called The Body Principle about the exercises that you can do to shape your body to look like me.
It's very interesting because I think David Goggins has the most, he's Rich Roll's most popular guest ever.
Yeah.
So there,
got it.
There may
well,
be
because
some,
people yeah. really want to believe that there is this willpower question behind transformation, or there
yes.
or even better that there is a little set of rituals like his accountability mirror. God, I mean, it's not like I didn't go through all of them at some various point when I was, you know, being trafficked on the Chinese junk or wherever I was, where I've got my gratitude journals, I've got my affirmations, I've got my, you know, accountability partner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. 12 step, blah, 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 all of it. And so, yeah, there's no special sauce. There's just the opportunity structure. There's the cost benefit analysis in the face of a certain opportunity structure, as we would call it in political science. And that can shift over time. And I think the insight that weird personality makes that more likely, that some shift in your opportunity structure is going to hit that weird piece of your personality just the right way and light a fire under your ass, that might be more likely for unusual personalities. It certainly was in my case. So I can relate to that. It's very, you're very, very sweetly characterizing 30 miserable years. but yeah, it's, I think, oh, go ahead.
It would have to be so that people of that have latent monster talent with a lot of openness and a lot of, you know, potential Achilles heels, those people will be rife for transformation stories like this.
And it's also rife for yeah. disasters.
Yes, you know? Absolutely.
It's really, we're perhaps more at the mercy of life's contingencies than other people.
Yes, right.
You know, it's sort of like, who do you meet? What do they offer you? What, yeah. you know, what drugs do they have? Yes. Where do you wind up living? Who do you date? These kind of things that Plowman would acknowledge, you know, those are the environmental factors that can really put you on a different path. And so that's, you know, for good and for ill for personalities with those unusual distortions.
Yeah. At the end of the day, the only good that gets done, in other words, when a person shifts to a better behavior pattern, it's with new information. Okay.
Yeah.
It's information that reduces distortion. Okay. So, the little gimmicky tricks are, you know, they might be an ancillary possible utility, you know, thing. I think maybe they are, but they are not the key and they are not the answer and understanding of this story. They may be 3% of the variance of the outcome. But the big issue is what shifted in the person's understanding of themselves and their universe that caused them to go down a different road because the cost-benefit looked, you know, the cost-benefit analysis lured them. Some new information hit their nervous system, okay? And that new information caused behavior which resulted in increasing accuracies of being able to properly analyze the contingencies around success. That's all. Cannot be anything else. Okay. So the thing that they are inferring, that the making up of a alter ego, that little kind of trick might be one trick of many that an individual might use in order to work their way around some ego trap motivation, you know, a motivational mm-hmm. ego trap. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I don't doubt that you could use that kind of thing. Some people, that might be a way for some people to help, you know, essentially help themselves work around an ego trap process. But there are many ways to do it. And there's ways that are going to be more effective than that, including, for example, explaining explicitly what the ego trap is and how it works. And then essentially as a counselor, explain to people, what reasonable expectations would reasonably be given the circumstances that you're in. Okay. That is more effective than any gimmicky trick like that. It's not even close. I know, because I've been using it for 25 years. Okay. So again, what changes people's minds? New information. And if the new information is true, then it will turn out that their predictions based on a modified cost-benefit analysis, as they start to go down a new road and invest their time and energies in a different trajectory, their expectations will be reasonably met because it's true. Okay? If it's not true, i.e. if Tony Robbins is wrong and you can't stare in the mirror and say great things about yourself, and then it turns out that you're going to lead the you know, Glenn Carey, Gary Ross in sales next year because of that, then it's going to turn out that you're full of shit.
A, he's B, C.
He's full of shit. You're full of shit. And this whole, all your motivation is going to be in the toilet in 2 weeks. But Tony Robbins got your money, so he doesn't care. Okay. So that's what all of this is about. So, you know, would people love to be able to leapfrog into a stratosphere of achievement? Of course they would. Do they feel sometimes the pressure of ego trap that is stopping them and they know they have more than the world is seeing? Yes. Okay. But is any of this, quote, did so-and-so change his personality? Oh, no, he didn't change his personality at all. He didn't change his personality. Jen Hawk is exactly the same personality that was floating down the Yangtze River in trouble. Same personality.
But yeah.
Whatever. Okay. Same personality, without a doubt. There's no question it's exactly the same personality. That personality had a set of data that came into her head. It altered cost-benefit analyses. It changed behavioral trajectories. And it turned out that she grasped some important realities better. And as a result, ruled out some alternative hypotheses that were worse. And then had her life trajectory get increasingly successful at achieving important goals. That's all. It's not mysterious. Okay? It's no more mysterious than, you know, the Hindenburg blows up and then the Goodyear blimp decides to put helium in instead of hydrogen and it works. Okay? That's how it goes down. All right.
Again, very good pun. Very, very good.
All right.
We talked about Goggins, and I must have brought him up since I don't think you know him.
No, I don't know anything about
the podcast. So yeah, I think I mentioned him as an example when we had a question on the last Living Wisdom Q&A about that laziness question. Do you remember that? Like, how can I be less lazy?
Okay.
And it was sort of, we addressed this idea that sometimes it's just the initiation energy, and that once you actually get off your ass and do something,
right,
then that's new information for your whole motivational system, where you start, you feel proud of yourself, your self-esteem mechanism kicks in, somebody else maybe mentions something. This is why it's the oldest advice in the book, that if you're in a rut, you know, dress, if you're working from home from Zoom in your sweatpants, improve your mood by putting on a sharp suit and feeling really good about yourself. You know, that and those are the kind of things. It's not that there's this magical process to that, but it can, if it's the right fit for your personality, give you a little bit extra sense of self-efficacy, getting out of that ego trap or whatever it is that you're stuck in. And then it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy that starts to pay dividends. And so I think Goggins, and you know, ran into a little bit of that, where he's like, you know, I am disgusted with myself. I've had enough. I know I've been in this position. And it's like, you just need a couple of days of getting your shit together. And one or two days of feeling like maybe I've got my shit slightly together gives you that much more sense of probability that you could maybe totally get your shit together, at least much more than you currently have. And that can be all that it takes to get you, you know, out of the ditch. So if little rituals are part of that, it's just like you're saying, it's an artifact. But
yeah.
If it's the right little tool for the job, then there's no great sin in it.
And my point is that people of unusual personality and talent can tell you of incredible, can tell tales of incredible transformation, but they don't understand at all that they are actually a remarkable and unusual personality that was in particularly shitty circumstances because of some Achilles heels in that personality. That in fact, all that they needed to get kicked in the shins in just the right way to get them move in the right direction. And then it turns out that they could then go on an achievement streak that was damn near inevitable as long as we didn't get stuck in a ditch. Okay. And so their stories, that story can be replayed by many, many people, but you won't hear of them because many, many people who have that type of thing happen to them are not themselves remarkably talented, so that we don't see evidence of them on the world stage. Okay. So this guy had the ability to make it be a Navy SEAL. That's no small thing. Okay. Not everybody can be a Navy SEAL. A lot of people try really, really hard and they can't get in. Okay. So, et cetera. So in other words, this guy had a lot of chops so that when we got his go-kart out of the ditch, something spectacular happened. Good for him. You know, I'm glad for him, but it wasn't a change in his personality. That I am 100% sure of.
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much as always. Some really wonderful answers. Really appreciate it. We'll look forward to, and also for Dr. Hawk, you mentioned that you talked about some version of this question on your Living Wisdom Library. So it's a good time for me to encourage people to go visit the Living Wisdom Library and maybe become members. I know You guys have regular talks there, some live Q&As with people on video. So it's always fun to check it out. And that's esteemdynamics.com.
Yeah, and you can see Jen and her dogs too.
And the guinea pigs.
The dogs. And the guinea pigs. The Roe v. Wade guinea pigs. That's
yeah. It. Any more pets?
Yeah, we have one coming up this weekend. Actually, if people want to join in time for that. So yeah, it's always fun. We really let our freak flag fly on those.
Yep. All good.
we're all buttoned up here at Beat Your Jeans.
Yeah, that's right. All right, Nathan. Well, thank you very much.
All right, you got it, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk. We'll speak with you guys next show. Have a wonderful
night. All right, sounds good.
Sounds good. Thanks for listening.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourjeans.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Jeans, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.